Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregenauer with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregen. We have a marvelous guest for you today. Actually, I think this is one of the kindest, gentlest, and brave men I know. I'm just really, really eager for you to meet him, and I will introduce you in a moment. Let me make sure he's there, though. David, are you there?
I am.
You're there.
Yep, and, I'm here. I've had a bit of difficulty getting through, but I'm here.
Okay. Well, let me do a little brief intro for my folks, and then we will go to you. First, people, my conference, our conference, the Center for the Study of Psychiatry conference, is it's all up on the web. It's April 17th, 18th, and 19th. It's on the Michigan State campus. It's called the Kellogg Center. It's a great place to go. We're doing it in collaboration with a retired professor of psychology there, Bertrand Caron, who wrote the first book ever on the therapy of people labeled schizophrenic. People are saying it's the best lineup they've seen. I hope you all will be coming. I think we're even going to be having some of the more establishment community coming. Times are changing. Interesting things are going on. So April 17th, 18th, and 19th, you can get it through Bregen.com, or you can go to empathictherapy.org, which is the center's website, empathictherapy.org. If you've never been to one of our conferences, they are inspiring, they're life-changing, they're positive, they're chock full of information, wonderful presenters on the most interesting programs. For example, two European programs, the Finnish program that in Lapland that treats almost all its first acute psychotic break youngsters without drugs and rarely keeps anybody on drugs. And they're literally wiping out so-called schizophrenia in Lapland because people get better. Another group from Sweden is going to talk about placing very distressed people into homes for therapy. We're going to have a pediatrician who's just become a dear friend, Dr. Ryan, who read one of my books and just stopped giving drugs to his patients and helped them come off, and has is thriving in a positive practice. There's going to be all kinds of interesting people there about psychotherapy, about self-help programs. It's really a wonderful conference. My book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, yes, we have sent out the backlog of hundreds of books that were originally ordered, and then we ran out. The publisher ran out of the first printing. The third printing has been done. It's doing well. You can get it on Amazon.com. But we still have available a two-for-one. We still have available that if you go to Bregen.com, not just the Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety book, but for the same price, the Antidepressant Fact book, which is a nice balance to the Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety book. And we're able to do that because the publisher, although keeping the book in print, had a large number in cartons and said, well, we like them for a very inexpensive price. We're able to get them very inexpensively. And so we're sharing that with you by giving those books away with the Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety book. So lots going on here, folks. I'm out there in the media and in the world more than ever. Not slowing down. I've come around and I'm starting over again. My guest today, his name is David Drew. He's an MD, Dr. David Drew. Great, it's a great pen name. Drew is, David is an interesting man. He grew up in a in a coal mining community. He says his dad actually loved every day of work. I mean, that's an interesting beginning, coming from a coal mining community in Great Britain. He went to medical school. He married the love of his life, which I deeply appreciated. He did it the first time, though. He was smarter than me. And she's still a love of his. She's still a love of his life. After his training in pediatrics, did he go off and make a lot of money, maybe come to the U.S., you know, and open a prep? No. He became the camp doctor at the northern refugee camps of Thailand. He did that for 2 years. Then from 1979 to 1984, he went to Nigeria. So this is not your usual guy. He then came back to Great Britain. And we're catching him at a great moment in time. Stay with us for this hour because we're very lucky to have him. He is, as of yesterday and today, embroiled in a huge evolving controversy in Great Britain because he blew the whistle. He didn't intend to be a whistleblower. He actually just tried to set right some of the problems they were having in the National Health Service, something he deeply believes in, interestingly enough. And boy, did they just slam him. And since it's a monopoly, once you're fired, you're fired. You don't go into private practice. So he went into a somewhat early retirement as a result of getting fired. His work and the work of others has resulted in a lot of ongoing controversy, a government report, and all kinds of things that deal with, on the one hand, the abuse of whistleblowers, which is a universal phenomenon, and also the issues of child abuse going unrecognized, elder abuse taking place right in the health service. I'm going to turn you over to David Drew and let him take a breath. He's been doing a lot of media the last few days and tell us what he'd like to. Hi, David.
Hi, Peter. Thank you very much for having me on your show. You're right. I've been with the media since 5 o'clock this morning, which is at this time it's 16 hours. So I'm weary, but I've still got enough for the next hour in me.
Then okay, you're going to quit, right? We're your last one for the day.
I think so. I think I've got to give my wife a little bit of attention before I go to bed, though.
Well, go ahead. I'm proud to be in that role. Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. Okay. So, yes, well, I was, as you said, not quite the ordinary doctor. My career's been up and down a little bit, and I've spent a lot of time overseas. I did actually come to the States for 3 or 4 months to work on a joint project when I was in Nigeria with Michigan State University. And unfortunately, because I'm 67 and memory's beginning to lapse a little bit, I can't quite remember who the pediatrician over there was that I was working with. But anyway, so for the last, up until 2010, for the previous 18, 20 years, I had been settled in the UK and working as a pediatrician at one of our large district general hospitals. Everything was, I loved that work, felt like it was made for me. And I never had a day's trouble in my career. I never had a complaint against my practice, which must be pretty uncommon because most people get a bit of that. But on the day that I started to raise concerns about problems in my department, and I was head of the department at the time, one particular consultant was, I thought he was incompetent. I questioned his competence with the hospital authorities. He sent a baby home to his death, a baby with suspicious, unexplained bruising that, according to the policy and according to the advice of his colleagues, should have been investigated by our social services. And a week later, this little 16-month-old boy came back with fatal head injuries and died on the intensive care unit the next morning. And from then on, over the next couple of years or so, I continued to raise concerns about this consultant. And eventually they got fed up with me complaining and removed me as the head of department, which, to be quite honest, I was not unhappy with, because it's quite a busy and stressful role, and I was looking to go back to just doing clinical practice. And unfortunately, at that time, we have something in the UK called PFI, Private Finance Initiative. And the government simply doesn't have the funds to provide the capital for new building programs. That's hospitals, roads, schools, and various other things. And so what they do is they get venture capital companies to come in to put up the capital. And then, unfortunately, because the arrangements that were made with these projects was very favorable to the venture capital company, and it's resulted in huge expensive debts for the hospitals, meaning that they have to cut their costs in the service. It's a little bit like you go out and buy a new house that you can't quite afford, so you can't really afford to eat properly or go on holiday anymore or run your car. So we were put under immense pressure to cut costs, and at that time they were making nursing staff redundant, making doctors redundant, trying to cut costs at every point without really thinking about doing it in such a way that we might at the same time make the service more efficient and more effective. And so a whole load of things went wrong at that time, and I blew the whistle on the whole thing. And eventually they suspended me from duty. And the reason they gave for suspending me from duty was the child that I mentioned who died. They claimed that I had stolen some information, letters, emails about him, and that I had leaked these to the press. Now, that was completely untrue, and a subsequent investigation did actually vindicate me on that. But nevertheless, by that time, the hospital authorities were thoroughly fed up with me and decided that it was time for me to go. So after a period of time in which there were more investigations and so on, they offered me a large sum of money, probably about the equivalent, I would have thought, of $300,000 or $400,000, to go quietly, immediately, not to cause any fuss, as with a really good reference so that I could get a job anywhere else in the National Health Service, but with the provision that I signed a gagging order and never spoke about these things again. They're called non-derogatory clauses, and it means you're not allowed to make negative comments about that organization again. So I met the chief executive of the hospital, and we had a chat about this with my British Medical Association representative. That's our medical union in the UK. And they offered me this money, and the union man said, "And what are you going to do if Dr. Drew refuses?" And they said, "We're going to take him into a disciplinary procedure, and he will be gone by Christmas." So I went home and talked to my wife and my family. I've got four children, 9 grandchildren. We had a long chat about it. I explained to them what the financial implications of me refusing this offer were. One, that I wouldn't get that money. Two, that it would affect my pension. And three, that I would find it very difficult to get any more work as a pediatrician. And it's in my book, and, you know, there's quite a few amusing things in my book, but my wife at that, we had a big family meeting about it. My wife said, "That's dirty money. If you take that money, I'll divorce you." And my oldest son said, "Yes." and speaking on behalf of all your children, we will never speak to you again. Forget it. So they gave me a bit of guidance on that. I wasn't going to take it anyway because I knew that there was a lot of wrongdoing going on in the hospital at that time, not just in my department. And so I refused to take it. They immediately started a disciplinary procedure against me. And 3 days before Christmas, that was in 2010, I was out on my ear. And I think I was about, I was 63 at that time. I think I probably would have worked for another 4 or 5 years, but I got early retirement. And I then had to start work trying to redress the situation by taking my employer through various employment tribunals. And I did that, and that took me two, three years, I think. But I lost all my claims and spent a lot of money on lawyers and ended up no better. In fact, financially, much worse than I'd started. So, but at that point, I began to meet over that period, from about 2011 onwards, 2012, I began to meet large numbers of other people who'd had similar experience in the NHS, whistleblowers, who'd, some of them, they'd just been badly bullied. Some of them had to leave the hospital they were working at. Some of them had been suspended, then reported to our medical regulator, the General Medical Council. Some of them had been dismissed and, again, tried to get through the employment tribunals, but with no luck, because that's very difficult in this country to win an employment tribunal against your employer. And so we then formed an organization called Patients First, and we began to campaign for the protection of doctors and nurses and other healthcare staff when they raised concerns about patient care. And the culmination of that has come today, actually, as it would happen. And that is that the government, 6 months ago, commissioned one of our very famous Queen's Counsels, very senior judge called Sir Robert Francis, commissioned him to do a full investigation of what on earth was going on with these whistleblowers. And he's put his report out today, which, unfortunately, we're not very happy with. There we are.
What does the report say in sum? What are you not happy with?
So the report is 200 pages long. And Sir Robert Francis received with his team, because he had a big team working on this, including researchers and statisticians, they received more than 600 long submissions from whistleblowers who'd had experiences in the National Health Service. They also did a phone survey. They gave our hospitals a telephone number and said, ask your staff to ring to tell us about their experiences raising concerns about poor care, patient harm, etc. They had almost 20,000 people phone up. Now, yes, that is massive, because most people are too busy to bother to remember what the telephone number is or even read it.
And too scared.
It is. It's a measure of the strength of feeling. And anyway, so it turns out.
Again, people need to remember your country is a fraction of our size. So
yes, we're about sort of less than 20% of your population. Yeah.
So this would be like 100,000 from our population.
It'd be massive, wouldn't it? Yes.
Yes.
So anyway, the upshot of it all is that he's done a really good job and a good analysis, and shocking. He's in the newspaper this morning, one of our better newspapers. There's a headline in which he says, the NHS crushes st- staff who raise concerns. And he's done a good job, given a very good account from all the information he's been provided with of what happens to patient, to the staff who raise concerns about patient care. And it's all sort of stuff like, okay, so many people, they raise a concern and nobody even takes any notice. They don't answer their emails. They're ignored. But then if they persist, what happens next is they start to get some bullying, some negative comment, some negative action, and then that goes on to victimization. And as in my case, they will then find a reason for suspending you.
Well, first they try to buy you. First they try to buy you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. At some point they will try and buy.
Is that common?
It's
so
it has
blatant.
Been very
so
common.
Gross.
And now, for about the last 20 years, there have been continual instructions given to our hospitals that you can't gag people when you're trying to pay them money to leave your organization. Because, obviously, the hospitals who want to maintain their reputations, they want to try and keep these sort of things quiet, and they are prepared to use taxpayers' money to do it, large sums often, and these gags prevent anyone in the outside world knowing that it's even happened. And I've seen him today, but one of our famous whistleblowers is a guy called Raj Mattu, very senior cardiologist. He was on his way to a professorship in London, and he raised concerns about an aspect of patient safety in his hospital. That was 10 years ago. It's taken 10 years of absolutely vile persecution by the authorities in his hospital. And it's cost that hospital somewhere between 10 and 15 million pounds. That's probably about 20-something million dollars already. In legal fees, administrative fees, and everything else. And he's just beaten them recently in the tribunal, and he stands to get probably something not far off $10 million in compensation for the fact that his career has been ruined, he can't earn any more money, and all the rest of it. So, you know, these things are, and they are quite widespread in the National Health Service. We've got many, many really, really good hospitals, and we love the NHS, and we do believe that it's a very good care model, that it's very cost-effective, that we get good outcomes compared to many countries. But there are some dark corners where the leadership is poor, where the culture is very difficult for people to work in, where the staff are not well engaged, and where bullying rates are high. And these are the kind of situations in which most of the whistleblowing cases arise.
Now, in our country, a department director would have a lot of rank. It sounds like because of the bureaucracy, there are people above you who have far greater control than the medical people.
Oh, right. Well, that is really interesting, Peter, because I mean, there's a general recognition now that hierarchies are bad for patient safety because the people lower down the hierarchies, they may know things or want to say things which the people at the top of the hierarchy, by abuse of power, can stop them feeding in. Now, in this country, in about 1983, I think it was, we had something called the Griffiths Report, which was about how the National Health Service should be managed. And since that time, over the last 30 or so years, we have adopted an increasingly general managerial approach. And we have brought in huge numbers of managers who are, you know, we used to call them the Sainsbury's managers. You might call them the Walmart managers, but the people who were trained in general management in retail and all the rest of it, who maybe somebody thought, because they had been trained in the general principles of management, would also be good at running hospitals and hospital departments. But this thing, we call it managerialism now, where these people have got the upper hand. And although in the good hospitals, where the leadership is good and where the leadership is secure in its own identity, that can work quite well because they listen to the clinicians. But in the worst situations, clinicians are generally sidelined, and they have to do pretty much what they're told. And some of them are just quite happy to do that, to get on with their clinical practice, keep their heads down. And unfortunately, in a number of serious public inquiries that we've had recently, they keep their heads down and don't take too much notice of all the things that are going wrong. And, you know, when there are cuts, the way that that affects the service, when there aren't enough nursing staff on the ward to look after the patients, and when you've got incompetent doctors around, when you haven't got enough doctors around. So there's been a swing over the last sort of 20 to 30 years towards the managers having the upper hand above and beyond the clinicians, although some of the managerial posts, of course, are occupied by senior doctors and nurses themselves.
David, we're going to – let me interrupt. We're going to go to break in maybe 30 seconds or so. This is really good. I'm really glad to just have you just talk about what's going on. When we come back, I'd like to hear about the kinds of abuses. I don't know if you were involved in any way with the elder abuse that was going on in some of the hospitals.
No, I'm not, but I know a lot about it.
Yeah. All right. The kinds of abuses that are going on. Also, why this report wasn't all you wanted and what more you're going to be doing. So we'll come back and talk actively.
Yep.
And just before we go to break, what's the name of your book and how do people find it?
Okay, right. So my book is called Little Stories of Life and Death at NHS Whistleblower. And the NHS Whistleblower has got no E at the end of it. It's L-O-W-R. And it can, if you just put Dr. David Drew or David Drew on Amazon, Little Stories of Life and Death, you'll find it.
Great. All right, well, we'll go to break, and we'll come back with my conversation with a genuinely moral man. And maybe we'll talk about also the origins of this moral man's viewpoint.
Thank you very much.
And I am just very much enjoying my guest. And he's just a remarkable man. His name is David Drew. He's a pediatrician. He has a book out called Little Stories of Life and Death. And if you just go and put in David Drew, British pediatrician, whistleblower, anything like that, you'll be sure to get him. I just want to give you a reminder about our conference, April 17th through 19th. And coming up, probably the best one we've ever done and the first one we've ever done in flyover country on the Michigan State campus. And love to see you there and meet some of my listeners there. And also, we have shipped out all the back orders because we finally got the new printing in. It's like the third printing of the book in just 2 months. And we still have that great offer where you can go to Bregan.com and get the book for the regular price and then get free the antidepressant fact book. And that's not a throwaway book. That's still in print, still costs the usual amounts of money in print, but you'll get it for free along with Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. David Drew has so much to say. I thought I would invite him to talk about three subjects. I hope we get to cover them. If not, we will have him back. One is the kinds of atrocities in addition to the overlooking of child abuse resulting in the death, the kinds of problems he's seeing, We've been reading about them over here. I think they're relevant to the problem of having a national health care system. I want to hear more just about him and how he became this man who went to Thailand and Nigeria as a pediatrician. And I want to hear where his life is taking him and also just where he got this morality from. So where would you like you pick up anywhere on that, Dr. Drew?
Okay. I think I'll just, because you're a psychiatrist, you'll appreciate this. I'll just talk a little bit about my childhood. And in as much as we have pristine memories of our childhood, which they've all probably been modified a little bit, but I was from a very working-class family. My dad was a coal miner. My mum worked in a factory. And we didn't have much money, but honesty was paramount. And I'll just give you one little example. On one occasion, I was with my friends in a shop in town, and I stole some marbles. And my father got to hear about it and came and found me out in the fields. And he just looked at me and said, "Have you stolen some marbles?" And I knew I couldn't say anything except I did. And he said, "Never steal anything again, David." He said, "If you want something like that, you come to me, and if I can give you the money for it, I will do." And that really, the shame, I mean, you've just been, your book, Guilt, Shame and Anxiety. I'm not a person who has suffered a lot from either, any of those, to be quite honest, I don't think. But I did feel very, very deeply ashamed at that. And that did have a profound effect on my life. But that kind of straight talking and just straight morality, it was always there through my childhood. And I'm sure that had a profound effect on me. And then when I went to university, I'd been there a few months and I'm not going to go into the whole experience, but I became a Christian. Before that, I'd been nothing really, but I met someone who was a Christian and fell into conversation, and something happened to me, whatever it was. I had some kind of conversion experience. I became a Christian. And I went home that night to my room at the university, and on the shelf, there were 5 books. And I sat down and made some coffee, and I looked at these books, and I felt them accusing me, because they were books from the biology department at my high school, which I hadn't returned when I left, which I'd kept. And I felt so dreadful about it that the next day, I went to the post office, bundled them up, paid for these, for the postage, which was quite expensive for a student on only a small stipend. And I wrote a letter to the teacher to say, "Dear Mr. Beecroft, I've become a Christian. I'm afraid I stole these books from you. I'm sending them back with £20 to be used to purchase new books for the library." And I think that sort of was quite a formative experience for me. Now, like everyone else, I tell lies from time to time. Sometimes if I get into a corner, or sometimes it's convenient to tell a lie. We all do that sort of thing. But I think I've learned my lesson about telling serious lies with an intent to mislead other people for personal gain. I think I've learned that. Now, that doesn't mean I'm a good person or anything like that. I think it's quite a pragmatic thing, actually. And I don't lie awake at night worrying about all the lies I've told.
But, you know, that's a radical, radical view of life. And, you know, it's one Ginger and I try mightily to live by, that we won't say an untruth for our own gain. Yeah. And boy, does that get you in trouble, but boy, does it lead to an interesting life. So if you want a key to an interesting life, folks, don't lie or evade important truths for your own gain. And believe me, I'm no saint either, but once you get that idea, and God forbid you have a wife who has the same idea, and you team up around an idea like that, then you end up with lives that resemble mine or Dr. David Drew's life.
Yeah, and I think that's so good. And I like to think of it as pragmatism. It's a practical way of going about life, and it works. Somebody once said that it's much more difficult to remember any account of something if you've lied about it, because there are about 5,000 possible things that you could say, but there's only one account of the truth, and it's always easier to remember what the truth was.
Well, you know, you were a long time in the health service, not making any complaints. So was it a kind of a determination over time that even there in that great jeopardy you were going to speak out? How did that come about?
Oh, I think that was just a completely I was unaware of what was happening. It just seemed to me that particularly over the little boy that died of the non-accidental injury, I was the head of the department. It just seemed to me like my ethical responsibility, my professional responsibility. And I was completely taken back at the response that I received. So, and then once you've done that, the next thing that comes along, you do it, and eventually you get to a point where you're so deep in, and then you start to realize that something is going wrong, and even if you wanted to, you probably couldn't go back at that stage. So that's how I got into it, and
I certainly had no idea when I did my first major project, which was trying to stop lobotomy from coming back, which turned out actually did pretty much accomplish. I had no idea what the recriminations and attacks would be, and the lack of support from within the establishment, joining the lobotomists and so on and so forth. It was a shock. There's so much buried evil in the universe.
There is.
You're glad you live in this life?
Oh, I'm so happy. Of course. I wouldn't have it any other way.
What does it look like for you for the future?
I'm 67. I'm not going to work again. I've got my work to do to continue trying to support some of the whistleblowers who have fallen foul of the system. And I've got 9 grandchildren, and we enjoy simple pursuits. We love outdoor walking and gardening, things which don't really cost very much money anyway, so that is no big problem. But going back to the whistleblowers who've had troubles, when I went down to London on the train to go to the launch of this report, I had a text on the way down from a nurse. And it just said, okay, I whistleblew 3 years ago. I was sacked. I haven't worked since. 2 weeks ago, I was given the job. But on day one, they called me out of the induction, told me to go home. And today they've told me that because of what happened in my previous job, I can't work for them. So she is a nurse, a good nurse. I've worked with her actually about 8 or 9 years ago. She's a good nurse, and she would speak up when things were wrong. And she's now well behind on her mortgage. She's likely to probably lose her house, and she's having to use food banks. We have these things called food banks now in our country. It's a shameful thing. And it's part of the country's austerity program. But we have more than 1 million people every week depending on free handouts, a little bit like the old soup kitchens, to supplement the food that they can actually buy. So And some of our nursing staff in the NHS are currently having to use those food banks. Shameful thing.
Is there any indication that the cost of having national health care is in part what's reducing the growth of your country and the availability of, you know, of good jobs and so on? I mean, one of the things the arguments made here in this country is that because you have your National Health Service, we have to have our national defense system to protect you because you don't have any other money left.
Yes.
Any truth in that?
I think that you run most of your, a lot of your expenditure is run on debt like ours, isn't it?
Yes, more and more.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, well, but you know, the richer you are, the more you can afford to be in debt. So,
yeah, but you did. You have said that politics is not your forte. Go, not what you've been preoccupied. Tell us some more about the kinds of abuses that have occurred under the system. We've got about 10 more minutes to talk about.
Yeah. Okay.
That.
So, for example, we've had an. We've had quite a number of scandals in elderly care homes where patients or elderly people have been neglected or actually abused. And one of the big problems is that I think that the some of the staff who work there, first of all, the places are run for profit, so here. Maybe it doesn't happen in other places, but if they're running them for profit, they try and cut the costs down to the bone to pay the shareholders or the owner, and they don't pay the nurses and the carers particularly well, and so they don't get the best people. Some of them are a bit rough, probably not very well trained. Some of them not particularly compassionate or empathetic. And as a result, and particularly because they're often not very well supervised, there have been some dreadful examples of elderly people and people with special needs being physically abused, not fed properly, not given drinks properly, not cleaned properly.
Yeah, what was the name of that place, David, that was so in the news, where people were literally drinking the water out of the planters?
Okay, right. Now, that was called Midstaffs, the Staffordshire Hospital.
All right. Now, was that private or was that part of the HS?
No, that is a National Health Service General Hospital.
Okay.
Or it was, because, in fact... it has ceased to exist as an independent hospital since that time, and although there is still a small hospital there providing services to the local people, a lot of the more difficult work is now farmed out to two or three of the surrounding hospitals. And like they don't have an emergency department open all day, that closes down in the evening, and patients go to hospital, which is 30 or 40 miles away. So, yeah, but that was, and I do know, in fact, I went to a lot of the public inquiry meetings up on that. And in fact, the Sir Robert Francis, who did this current whistleblower inquiry for us, he also ran an independent inquiry into care at Midstaffs, and then he ran the public inquiry into all of the way that all of the regulators and other bodies responsible for overseeing the running of that hospital. So he did all that. But oh yeah, there's some. I know the. In fact, it's very interesting because that inquiry would never have happened. That hospital would have carried on as it was, doing all kinds of dreadful things, but the patients, and particularly the relatives, they formed themselves into a group, they got themselves a real action plan, They secured the help of the press and television to some extent and radio, and they started a campaign, and over a long period of time, they finally managed to get the head of our health ministry to agree to a full inquiry about what was going on. And of course, a lot of very, very dreadful things came out about that. And why, you know, why it all happened, it's too complicated to talk about in a few minutes, but basically they all lost sight of the fact that the primary objective of running a hospital is to care for vulnerable people. They lost sight of that. But I have to say that even in that hospital, there was still a lot of really good care going on in some of the departments, some of the wards. And it's patchy. It, to some extent, you know, depends on the people who are running a particular ward, and also the leadership that they've got in that ward. Yeah, so that is a huge story. It's take a week to read the inquiry report, and in fact, I think it's Sir Robert made 296 recommendations, which were then to be applied to the whole health service to make sure that that sort of thing never happened anywhere again.
What were you disappointed about in his report on the whistleblowing?
Yeah, okay, I'm going to tell you very simply, and it's quite quick, this is, and that is that there are three things. First of all of the whistleblowers that have been sacked and ruined, he came to a very definite understanding of how dreadful all that was, and it's described in his report, and he knows how the whistleblowers have suffered and how they've... For example, at one point it says many of the whistleblowers... No, it says many of the whistleblowers became ill, some died, and some committed suicide as a result of their treatment. So he said all that. It was all about how they lost their jobs, lost their careers, how some of them had family breakdowns, lost their houses, everything. So he understood the situation, but then at the end he did not make a single recommendation to help to bring relief to these people who they are now calling heroes and courageous. He did nothing for them. And as a result, other staff in our health service are going to look at that and say, well, if you do get into trouble when you raise concerns, nobody's going to help you. Even Sir Robert Francis didn't bother to do anything for them. And the people, the managers who are doing the victimization of these staff, they're going to look and say, oh, well, we got away with that. So they are... Now, the big thing that Sir Robert has done in this report, and it's a good thing, is he said, we need to develop a just culture in the health service where when people make mistakes, they're not blamed for it, they can put their hands up, we learn from the mistakes, it never happens again, but... There are some times when people do things maliciously or it's a matter of total incompetence, and we have to deal with that. That's what he meant by a just culture. But as I've said today in the meeting, how can you build a just culture on the basis of the kind of injustice that our whistleblowers have suffered, and you are going to allow them just to drift off with ruined lives? And the nurse that I told you about... who's losing her house and all the rest of it. She's not untypical. And the thing, I cannot understand how such a man of such integrity has understood what the problem is, but has made no recommendations to our government to help or assist those whistleblowers. But as you know, this sort of thing happens to whistleblowers all over the world, and largely they lose. And nobody cares too much about it, which is sad.
Well, my experience is that you get to be a person of power and authority by being a person without a conscience.
There's no doubt about that. I mean, you're the psychiatrist, but in the last 4 years, since I've been doing a lot of work through social media, I have come across a large number of psychiatrists, psychoanalysts, psychologists, psychotherapists. And It's quite clear. Well, there is a big concentration of people with sort of borderline psychopathology, narcissists, and all the rest. They do concentrate among chief executives. There's no doubt about that. And they're people without any feelings for others. They don't understand that. They don't seem to have any conscience about anything. Some of them seem to enjoy the consequences of their behavior. And it doesn't matter what they've done that day to upset people or hurt them. They go home, have their tea, go to bed, and sleep soundly. That's it. Is that true?
I think it's true, yes. I think it's absolutely true. They feel entitled. They feel justified.
Yeah, they do.
And
very often with them, you are absolutely fine until you do something which goes against them. And then they come for you. And that is exactly the whistleblowing situation, of course.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It'd be interesting to see if Parliament tries to remedy this. It's possible that you all might be able to stimulate some legislation now that you've got that report out to help some of these people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I need 24 hours to have a rest and to read the report in a bit more detail. And then we will get back networking with all the people in the groups, and we'll...
Well,
the thing is,
I've had
so many years of disappointment now that it doesn't bother me even. I just know that we're going to pursue this until we get a result.
Folks, you've been listening, and I hope you feel as privileged as I do to have spent time with Dr. David Drew, retired pediatrician from the National Health Service, where he found out what happens when you speak truth to power, but he's going to keep on doing it. A moral man. Thank you for being on the Peter Bregan Hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter, and best wishes to Ginger, too.